Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles range. We have your van.
Well, after five wins at this year's Cheltenham Festival, perhaps the greatest of his many comebacks from injury, jockey Barry Geraghty announced his retirement. He recalls the triumphs and disasters of his racing career in a memoir now called True Colours, co-written with Niall Kelly. Barry Geraghty joins me in studio. How are you?
Very good.
You have had a very productive lockdown, haven't you?
Well, it was quiet, but we had our, well, I won't say we had a plan in place, but I had my plan made from early in the spring. Of what I was going to do.
From early in the spring, because you were withholding information about what your plans were for quite a long time, weren't you? When did you actually sit down and start putting pen to paper?
On the book, it's going back, it's over a year. So we had done a lot of work before lockdown. Mm-hmm. And myself and Niall Kelly, who has the patience of a saint, we'd gone through a lot before lockdown had kicked in. And then we were working on Zoom. So I suppose we maybe had more time in our hands at that stage as well. So we did hours and hours on Zoom.
It's a really, really super read, because what you have managed to do with Niall is put people there on the horse's back in so many of those races. I had seen them. I had seen a good number of them, but I found myself gripping the book with white knuckles, saying, what was the outcome here? What happened? What happened? Did he fall? Did he get over the line? But before we get into the races and the horses themselves, one of the things that surprised me here is you should have really been of racing royalty, given your grandfather's outstanding success as a breeder, but you were of a very modest background in the 80s.
Yeah, well, farming was the business at home. But no, my grandfather bred Golden Miller, who he won five Cheltenham Gold Cups and the Intergrand National
back-to-back
in the 30s. He did five Cheltenham Gold Cups back-to-back and the Grand National in 1 year, along with the Gold Cup. He's the only horse to have done that double. So that was what we grew up in the knowledge of.
That's admission to the Pantheon, to the Hall of Fame straight away. But yet your dad almost ended up going to the States to seek work as a labourer.
Yeah, back in the 80s, farming was on its knees. Dad went to America for a few months and he was working there and had...
And there was no guarantee there was going to be horses in your future, was what I mean.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. He was trying his hand at a few different things, but he had the offer then of a job managing a stud farm outside Boston, and the decision was made, do we go or do we not? And we stayed at home and I had no part in the decision. I was 11, I think, or so. And we opened a riding school and that grew and that put me into a world of horses. And
which you started with pony racing, which is a mad little subculture that not many people know about in this country. Talk to me about pony racing.
Pony racing, it's brilliant. So you have ponies and horses, but it's around the country. It'd be in a field, you'd have the track might only be 600 or 700 metres round, so it's a tight circuit.
You have to learn to be pretty fearless pretty early on.
Fearless, you know, you have to balance everything. You test your riding, and you know it's a brilliant learning curve for any young jockey. And you see the current lads coming through. Young Sam Ewing, who's ripping it up at the minute, he's a former pony race champion as well. And you know, go back before that, Norman Williamson, Charlie Swan, Adrian Maguire. So when I was doing that, I was living the dream at that moment as well.
Was that where the bug bit, or had you a love of horses from the moment your dad opened the riding school?
Yeah, no, I would have had a love of the horses right through it through. From I was on a pony before I could walk, and whenever I had the chance. And I suppose I had more confidence on a pony. I was no good at football, so I was too small as well.
But, picked on in school a bit as well.
Well, I was a sensitive child, and I cried when others might shrug their shoulders, but
was that down to your size?
Probably. I started school, my birthday's in September, and I started on my fourth birthday, so I was probably a little bit small and a little bit young and easy intimidated, but I got great confidence riding ponies. And that really grew.
One of the things that's always struck me about listening to your interviews is that you have an appreciation of the personality of an awful lot of these horses as well. And it really, really comes through. So let's just talk about some of the individual horses. And well, starting with the one that made you, that we will forever and a day associate you with, Moscow Flyer. He was a little bit of a weirdo, a bit of a tricky character.
He was. The first day I sat on him was in a schooling race in Punchestown, which is like a friendly match, if you like. And we're galloping along, having jumped a couple of hurdles, going around a bend. He decided he was going to take a shortcut across the inside. And
and you had no say in the matter.
I had no say in the matter. We galloped into a marker pole and turned over. So I get off, I picked myself off the ground, he galloped away, and I'm thinking, that lad's a bit of a mind of his own.
Would you not have thrown the reins back at Jessica Harrington at that stage and said, no, never again?
No, I rode him about 10 days later in a maiden hurdle and he bolted up. He won his next two. The third one was a grade one in Ferrios, which when I was 20. So I actually was my first grade one that day, but I'd won a grade one earlier on Alexander Banquet for Willie Mullen. So I had a grade one double on my first day riding a grade one winner. So that was a brilliant start, if you like. But Moscow was, to have a horse like that, and from where he took me all the way through my career, was amazing. But you know, he was a flawed hero, if you like. He'd take his eye off the ball, his concentration levels weren't great, and I suppose his lack of, or his indecision in front of a fence, made my decision harder. So he wasn't a straightforward ride. And actually the last race I won on him in Aintree in 2005, I got off and I said to Jesse, "John, that's the first really good ride I've got off him. He just made it so easy that day." And that was...
That one day.
But he was brilliant.
He enjoyed a nice retirement in the National Stud and died 4 or 5 years ago, I think now, when he colicked. An emotional day for you, I understand.
Yeah, it was. It was sad. We'd been threatening to get down to visit him with the kids for so long. But like everything else, you keep putting it off and putting it off, and eventually we got down, and thank God we did, because if I hadn't got to let the kids meet Moscow Flyer, I would have been something I would have regretted always. So, but it was sad. He was an amazing horse, and he was a brilliant personality.
He was the horse that made you, the horse that kind of cemented your reputation, though, has to be Sprinter Sacra. By way of contrast with Moscow Flyer, an absolutely incredible looking animal. I went to Punchestown in 2013 to see him in the flesh, I think, along with about everybody in three or four other counties who was there, and nobody was looking at any other horse in the parade ring other than Sprinter Sacra. Was that why you fell in love with him?
From day one, he had a big reputation, but he just did everything with such ease and such grace, and he would take you through a race, you know, going a million miles an hour. He'd be tanking when you're beside, you know, what's been talked up as being a fellow superstar, and you're looking across at him, and the jockey's pushing the ears off him, and you're swinging out of your fella, trying to keep a lid on him, keep him relaxed. You know, he jumped with such ease. I never rode a horse who could just go at a fence and, you know, take off and land the far side. The distance he could give it, the height he could give it, and it was all with such ease.
When his career ended, take us through that race and what was happening and what went wrong.
So I rode him in Kempton in Christmas, I can't think what it was, 14 or so, and or 13 maybe, and he... on reflection, he was going down to the start. He was a little bit quiet. So he's usually goes down, he's pulling your arms out, he's ripping up the place. And he was a little bit quiet going to the start, and you move on anyway. And as he went through the race, where normally he would be charging at fences and taking off and picking up early, there just wasn't this charge or urgency about him. And I'm sitting thinking, this isn't right, but I'll just sit and wait and see what happens. And I think it was the first fence down the back straight. I said, right, we need to go and we need to ping this one. Get a little bit competitive, see if I can switch him on, see what's happening. And as I'm approaching the fence, I'm letting the stride lengthen, trying to give him a squeeze to just see what's there. And I could feel the response wasn't there. So I just left him. I sat quiet, let him take a small little pop over the fence. And when he landed, I just pulled him up straight away.
Well, other lads might have made the decision to get the whip out and try and keep him in the race. You said no. And it's something that you've taken criticism for throughout your career. But it was absolutely right, because he had a heart condition. What was it? An atrial fibrillation or something like that?
Yeah, an irregular heartbeat. And there was no sign or indication of anything. And I didn't even give him a push. But I knew if this fellow's right, he'd be pulling my arms out. He wasn't pulling my arms out, so there was something really wrong. So I just pulled him up, got him stopped, got him back to the stands quietly, and they checked him out and they checked his heart, and he had a regular heartbeat. So it could have been desperate had
absolutely. He could have had a heart attack and dropped dead there and then on the racetrack. And it's very often, it's the thing that animal rights groups and critics of National Hunt point towards, is the cruelty of the sport. What's your reaction to people who don't see that, well, jockeys actually have a very, very often a very, very empathic relationship with these horses?
Oh, completely. And you know, it's I suppose it's easy to beat us for what we do, but you know, we care and love these horses so much. And you know, from their youth, they're minded, they're fed, they're cared for. Everything is they live like royalty. And you know, that moment I got him stopped, I had an unfortunate moment with Max Joy back in 2007 when he had a fatal injury down the back straight in Cheltenham. And you know, I got off him, I knew what was facing us, and you know, I handed him to the horse
ambulance.
You were
bawling. Bawling your eyes out.
I walked away, dropped to my knees, blocked my ears, and yeah, cried. So it was
blocked your ears, so you didn't have to hear.
I
what
didn't
was
hear
happen.
The crack. Yeah. So it was, yeah. We have a great connection. We grew up with horses. We love horses. We're like a dog person. It's the same thing, and you just love and you want them to do well. And the last thing you want to see them any injury.
Do you think that the sport is going to be forced to change?
Well, the sport is evolving the whole time, but I think education is the key. Like, the whip is so well padded, it's you know, there's no offence in it, and a horse runs from the sight of the whip. Because the crack off the whip is how it's designed, is for a crack, but impact is close to zero. You can smack your hand as hard as you want with it, and there's no pain.
They really don't hurt because there's so much sponge in them, isn't there? 2003, Moscow Flyer and Kicking King had brought you very much to the top of your game. You were, you know, astride the world stage. But the name of the game is that by 2006, people were calling you yesterday's man. That was a pretty cruel turn of events. How did it happen?
It probably through losing. Moscow Flyer was retired. Kicking King got injured. So I was riding mostly for Jessica Harrington, also Edward O'Grady, Tom Taff. And Edward and Tom had both approached me as regards taking on roles as first jockey. So, but I didn't, because I didn't want to commit to one. I had the choice of the three, okay, if you like, and it was working well.
We should explain to people who aren't perhaps fans here that a retained rider stays with one stable, doesn't get what you had, which was the pick of all of the best horses, but they have a little bit of job security. And you said when a trainer as big as Paul Nicholls came to you and offered you a retained job, you said, no thanks very much, I want to be footloose and fancy free. What would 41-year-old Barry Geraghty say to 23-year-old Barry Geraghty about that now?
Yeah, it happened that way. And probably unfortunate through the horses that I had at the time, Moscow and Kicking King especially. In 2005, Moscow won the Champion Chase and Kicking King won the Gold Cup, and we're back 12 months later with neither. So it happened. Would I do anything differently? No, I don't think so. It led to where it was, and do you know, it's when the tide turns, it's very hard to swim against it. And the weight of opinion goes against you, and people are saying he's gone and he's... And
what people were saying, and I wonder how it is you coped with this, because at the time the specific criticism was, sure, Barry Geraghty's not that good, he just got on good horses. Did you ever start to believe that yourself?
No, self-belief was something I never lacked in, and I was always waiting and working on the next, and at that stage, it was to get on the next horse who had a chance of winning. It wasn't even to get on a superstar. A superstar was probably a remote thing, but I just kept the head down, kept working, and you know, you work yourself back into opportunity again, and was very fortunate how it happened with Nicky Henderson.
You also detailed, though, that at this time that, yes, you were working hard, but you were partying very, very hard as well. Like, I mean, not knowing how you got to bed the night before a Grand National is quite a battle story to be sharing. When things started professionally to go off the rails a little bit, did you feel life slipping just a little bit out of focus? Did you keep partying hard, or did you knock it on the head?
That was the world I grew up in, and I suppose I was more than happy to embrace it and enjoy the fun, enjoy the crack. It wasn't affecting results. As you said, I was a late night the night before winning the Grand National, and that wasn't uncommon. And you rolled on the following day to the races and put in a performance, and the fact that you had a late one the night before, it glorified it even more. So it wasn't a continuous thing, but it was a very much occasional and could be regular enough. Whether that had any impact on the pace that my career was going at, I'm sure maybe it did, but opportunities were slipping away from me and momentum was with other jockeys and not with me, I suppose.
You got back, you made a comeback, and then you made another comeback again after that, up and down, the very, very opposite of what a stable, secure, steady job is. I've been trying to think of a question to sum up how it is that you feel about your career and this job now. And the best one that I can come up with is, when you look to your three children now, would you let them do what it is that you've done for the last 24 years?
I wouldn't stop them. Definitely wouldn't
stop them. Would you encourage them?
If they wanted to go that route, I would be behind them 100%. Would I chase them into it? No. But I wouldn't chase them into playing rugby over football or over soccer or anything.
And why wouldn't you chase them into it? I mean, does that mean that on balance there were more bad days than good days in this career?
No, but I suppose, you know, the attrition rate is brutal as regards injuries. You know, I've broken everything. You know, I suppose, like, I've broken arms, legs, wrists, thumbs, ribs, you name it, vertebrae, neck, back, everywhere. So it's, you know,
but you're here now and you're looking pretty healthy.
Yeah, no, I'm in good shape. But would I fancy sitting at home watching them ripping around the race course, knowing the potential risk involved? If they wanted it, I wouldn't stand in the way.
Well, you know what it would
them.
Be? It would be karma, wouldn't it? It would be certainly your wife, Paula, getting her own back, saying, now you know what it feels like.
I know, but she'd be on the edge of the seat beside me.
Yeah, wouldn't she? All right, the book is called True Colours, Barry Geraghty and Niall Kelly. It is a really, really good read, one that I would recommend to any National Hunt fan, any sports fan. Barry Geraghty, great to see you looking so hale and hearty and healthy. What's next?
I'm enjoying life at home at a steadier pace. You know, I've been, you know, on the run for the last 24 years, and it's only when you step away from it that you realise that, you know, there is a steadier pace there, and I'm enjoying that. I'm enjoying time at home with the family, some young horses, and that's a good interest for me.
All right, take care. The very best of luck.